20-year-old Karina Holmer dreamed of seeing the world beyond her small home village in Sweden. After her completion of secondary school, she wanted to travel before moving on to a career path. After looking for options, she decided to become an au pair for an American family. Low on funds, she got lucky when a scratch-off lottery ticket rewarded her $1,500. Unfortunately, her luck would soon turn to tragedy. Arriving in America through an under-the-table agency, Karina was placed with a well-to-do family in Dover, Massachusetts. Initially, she loved her job and the fringe benefits, such as being allowed to stay in her employer's Boston loft on the weekends. Moving in a circle of fellow au pairs and nannies, Karina enjoyed the nightlife and was living life to its fullest. Something changed, though, and Karina began writing letters home about cutting short her stay and returning early. She told family she wanted to travel elsewhere, but to her friends, she hinted at something more sinister. In one of her last letters, she explained that something terrible had happened, though she would never get the chance to explain what it was. On a Friday night in June, Karina went out with friends to hit the clubs and bars. She drank a lot that night, and when her friends were looking for her at closing time, she was nowhere to be found. For the next 30 hours, Karina was missing, though no one knew, until early Sunday morning, when a homeless man made a grisly discovery. In a dumpster, not far from where she had last been seen, inside of a black trash bag, he found her dismembered remains. A major investigation was launched, and the Boston police were determined to find the perpetrator who had committed this terrible crime. The more they dug into the area and Karina's life, the larger their suspect list grew, and the more bizarre clues were found. Was it a random attack? A former boyfriend or aggressive suitor? Or could Karina have been killed by a member of the family responsible for hosting her? This is Trace Evidence, Episode 60, The Murder of Karina Holmer. Welcome to Trace Evidence. I'm your host, Stephen Pacheco. Today we examine the gruesome murder of 20-year-old Karina Holmer, a case I've been researching for over a year. Before getting into the case, just a few notes about the show. Trace Evidence is a weekly true crime podcast focusing on a different unsolved case each week. Subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, or your favorite podcatcher. If you have questions, comments, or case suggestions, email me at traceevidencepod@gmail.com. Follow me on Twitter at traceevpod, on Instagram at traceevidencepod, or join the Facebook discussion group simply by searching for Trace Evidence. You can visit the website at trace-evidence.com for full episodes, transcripts, social media links, merchandise, and much more. Trace Evidence is also on Patreon, so if you'd like to support the show, please visit patreon.com/traceevidence, where you can get rewards such as stickers, pins, and commercial-free episodes. There's also a PayPal donation link on the website for those of you who don't wish to go through Patreon. This show is a complete one-man operation, and your support is greatly appreciated. As a final note, I'll be making an appearance at a podcast meetup in Atlanta this October. The meetup will be comprised of other true crime podcasts, including The Fall Line, Moms and Murder, Corpus Delicti, and many more. The event will take place between 2 and 5 p.m. at the Thinking Man Tavern on Saturday, October 13th. For more information, visit trace-evidence.com, and I hope to see you there. Today we examine the murder of Karina Holmer. This is a terrible case, and may contain information disturbing to some listeners. With a crime as sadistic as this one, you'd expect there to be a lot more coverage, And yet this is one of the many crimes which has, in some ways, seemingly been forgotten. While details are scarce, I've compiled everything I could find, and I believe it's a story worth being told. This is Episode 60, The Murder of Corina Holmer. Corina Erika Holmer was born in Ullared, Vagaridskommun, Jönköpingsland, Sweden, on June 23, 1975. At the time of her birth, Corina had an older sister named Johanna, and the two were very close. Ullared is a small village located 199 miles, or 319 kilometers, to the southwest of Stockholm, the Swedish capital. Specific details about Ullared itself are difficult to come by, though all descriptions seem to indicate it to be a quiet area with a low population that can draw in some tourism, but is not necessarily the prime location most travelers are seeking out. The Vagarid municipality of Ullared belongs to and contains the locality of Hvillingared, a much larger area boasting a population of over 13,000 inhabitants. At some point in time, Corina's family would end up moving to Hvillingared, and this is where they lived during her later journey to the United States. From a young age, Corina was described as a headstrong woman who was determined to achieve her goals. Neighbor Iris Hansen later said, quote, "Corina was a tough girl who knew what she wanted," end quote. Never one to shrink away from a challenge or to give up on reaching her goals, she quickly endeared herself to her family for her tenacity and drive. It was apparent early on that she was intelligent and focused, but that her dreams did not necessarily lie within the boundaries of her home country. She was fascinated by the world at large and wanted to travel, to see it all, and to experience everything the world had to offer. At approximately age 8, Corina joined a scouting organization, essentially the equivalent to what Americans would refer to as the Girl Scouts, though it should be noted that in Sweden, there is no particular designation based on gender, and both boys and girls are simply known as scouts or guides. In addition to scouting, Corina had an interest in animals, specifically horses, and would later join a pony club where she would learn the art of riding, both professionally and for recreation. Her determined and sharp personality would push her to excel at everything she thrust herself into, and the club was no different. After a short while in proving her skills, Corina would become the chairman of the pony club, taking on more responsibility and setting an example for her fellow members. Corina's father, Ola Holmer, would later speak of his daughter highly, referring to her as a nice girl who had never looked for trouble and a beautiful young woman who had the world in the palm of her hand. Corina has been described as a good student, showing as much focus and determination in her studies as everything else in her life. She was also thought of as somewhat of a dreamer, and while she had a grasp on the structure of her studies, she also had an artistic flair that couldn't be suppressed. Her love of art grew as she aged, and she even began to experiment in art herself. In 1992, when Corina was 16, she wrote a poem entitled Life, which read in part, quote, "The richest gift you've ever got is life. Don't throw it away or ever step on it, but hold it high in your hands," end quote. It seemed clear to those around her that Corina possessed a wise perspective on life and the world around her. She wanted to live each moment to its finest extent and to never look back, having wished that she had done more. When Corina was finished with school, she decided that it was time for her to experience the world. Before going away to college and buckling down with a career and building a family, she wanted to fulfill some of her dreams, and traveling to the United States was high on that list. At the time, it was a question of finances and being able to travel and provide for herself in the country. It was around this time, when Corina was 19, that she began to look into the possibilities. This led her to the option of working as an au pair for an American family. An au pair is basically a nanny who assists in watching children and housework, and in return, receives a monetary allowance and a place to stay provided by the host family. In the United States, there are official programs and procedures for this which must be followed. A potential au pair will seek out a family via an officially licensed agency. The agency is then required to perform all legal and official steps necessary to grant the au pair access to the country, including a work visa, typically for 13 months. Part of the visa application requires that an application is sent to the embassy or consulate in the applicant's home country, where the individual will later be interviewed. The process also involves a background check and the examination of medical records, including participation in a psychological examination. Typically, after all requirements are met and an individual is selected, they will travel to the United States, at which point they are to undergo an orientation and training before being officially united with a host family. While this can be somewhat of a lengthy process with a lot of steps necessary, it is considered extremely important to follow official protocol. This ensures the safety of the au pair, as well as the host family vetting the person they are bringing into their lives, and more importantly, the lives of their children. Unfortunately, as with all situations that involve a lot of red tape, there are those who will conduct under-the-table transactions and can expedite the process, bringing in potential au pairs through illegal means, failing to provide them with visas, and severely removing many of the safety roadblocks in place. Whether done on purpose or purely as a matter of happenstance, it is through one of these illegal agencies that Karina would eventually begin her journey as an au pair. Karina was low on funds, and she simply couldn't afford to travel to the United States, nor to hop through some of the hoops necessary to become an au pair. Her luck, however, was about to change, and while Karina would be incredibly excited by the possibilities, it would be the first step in what would lead to a tragic series of events. In early 1996, Karina purchased a ticket in the Swedish lottery. There is no discussion of whether or not this was a normal activity for the young woman, but in this case it paid off. She ended up winning $1,500, which she was determined to put towards her travels. She came upon a Swedish agent who offered her the possibility to achieve that dream. Tej Sundin, who operated an unlicensed agency and had twice in the past been convicted for doing so, presented Karina with her options. The specifics of what occurred between the two is unknown, especially what kind of deal Sundin offered and how it was executed, but what we do know is that in March of 1996, Karina Homer arrived in the United States, set to work as an au pair for a Boston family. She had no visa, was not registered with any official agencies nor the American State Department, and at the time was in possession of false identification. Some have debated whether or not Karina was aware of the illegal nature of her situation, but it seems apparent to most she had to have been. She knew the process needed, and she certainly knew that not having a visa and carrying a fake ID was not the normal protocol. Either way, the 20-year-old was excited to begin her journey. Her work as an au pair would see her staying in the Boston area with her host family through the summer, at which point she would be returning to Sweden to begin the next steps of her life. Karina promised friends and family that she would write often, and she kept her word, sending letters sometimes as often as weekly. In the beginning, the letters were lighthearted and positive, but as time ran on, they began to take on a more negative connotation. While Karina remained mostly positive in her writings to family, the letters that she sent to her friends told a different story. Karina was matched with a wealthy couple living in Dover, Massachusetts, approximately 16 miles southwest of Boston. 43-year-old Frank Rapp was a commercial photographer, and his wife, Susan Nichter, was a painter. The couple lived in a large home in a well-to-do area, and during the week Karina would stay there. Her duties included looking after the couple's two children, as well as assisting with household chores and keeping the home clean and neat. One benefit of working for the Rapp family, in terms of exploration, was that Frank Rapp owned a loft on Avenue A in the Fort Point area of Boston, and on weekends, Karina was able to stay there, giving her the freedom to experience the city and spend time with friends. Thanks to her fake ID and the more relaxed restraints of the time, the 20-year-old was able to gain access to bars and clubs, to drink, and to party. Neighbors reported seeing Karina frequently, outside with the children. At the time, the eldest child, the Rapp's son, was in first grade and their daughter was a toddler. According to all accounts, Karina very much enjoyed spending her time with the kids and had a lot of fun with them. She was enamored by their free-spirited behavior and noted the differences in how children were raised in the United States as opposed to in Sweden. It was all brand new to her, and for the time, she loved what she was doing. A neighbor later explained that Karina would often wave and seemed extremely friendly, but at the same time, somewhat reserved. The neighbor stated, quote, "She was friendly, but she was very quiet. I never saw her socializing with the neighbors," end quote. The job afforded Karina the ability to stay in a nice place, as well as the funds to enjoy her weekends out. She ended up making friends with other au pairs and nannies in the area, and they would often make plans to get together and go dancing. Rapp and Nichter have been rather reserved in their statements about Karina, predominantly speaking through a legal representative, but according to them, Karina was a hard-working, bright, vibrant, and kind young woman who they very much appreciated having under their employ. They would state that Karina was welcomed in as another member of their family, and that she seemed happy and excited to have been working and living with them. Their children, it was noted, adored Karina and were always happy and excited to spend time with their Swedish nanny. There is, however, some debate about how Karina herself felt as time went on. Her letters home began to take a more negative turn. With her family, she was somewhat vague and kept a more positive spin on it. Her sister Johanna later stated, quote, "She wanted to go somewhere else to travel and to work," end quote. A friend Charlotte Sandberg, though, received more direct examples of why she was thinking about cutting her stay short. In one particular letter, she explained, quote, "There's always so much cleaning, and I think I am stressed all the time, so this is not exactly what I thought it would be," end quote. The times where Karina seemed most happy was on weekends, when she had the freedom to do what she wanted. I should note here, some people have framed Karina as a so-called party girl who just wanted to go out to bars, dance, and have fun, and while I am sure Karina enjoyed her weekends, this doesn't sound all that different from any other person in their early 20s. There's never been any accounting of her engaging in heavy drug use or performing risky behaviors. She was, if nothing else, an independent woman who liked to have fun. Not so different from where many of us have been at some point in our lives. By May of 1996, Karina's writing to friends took on an even darker connotation. She began to talk about her unhappiness with her job, moving on from her current place with the family in Boston, and actually coming home. In a letter penned to her friend Ulrika Svensson, Karina wrote, quote, "Something terrible has happened. I'll reveal more when I get home," end quote. What the terrible incident was, whether it happened to Karina or someone else, any details about it have never been discovered, and Karina would not make it home to explain the situation. Just a month later, she would vanish for a period of 30 hours before a grisly discovery would reveal her devastating fate and launch a massive investigation. In regard to her change in tone, Martin Weinberg, an attorney for Rapp and Nichter, expressed that they were completely unaware of any unhappiness or stressful situation she may have been dealing with. In an interview with reporters, Weinberg stated, quote, "I don't know whether the letters represent her overall feelings, but if those were her feelings, she was able to not have them interfere with the relationship with Frank and Susan's children, which is the cornerstone of any au pair relationship," end quote. Many of Karina's friends, though, did seem to be aware that something was off, though they were never told what exactly it was. Either way, it didn't seem to get in the way of their nights out, and the evening of Friday, June 21st, was no different. The usual plan for the group of friends involved meeting at the loft that Rap owned, where Karina stayed on weekends. They gathered together and walked down towards the theater district. The hotspot of the time was Zanzibar, an upscale club located on Boylston Place next to the Colonial Theater. The crowd was described as having a higher-class clientele, but a laid-back environment. Many who had attended described it as a peaceful place, with good music and a fun-loving crowd. A safe place, without the threats or worries that can come with some of the more rowdy clubs in the area. Attendees of the club were aware of their foreign friends, and many men approached the au pairs, looking to dance close to them, under the strobing lights and bass-driven music. Karina was part of a group that locals referred to as the Swedish Nannies, and while she normally blended in with that group, on this night, her clothing made her stand out. She wore a sparkly gray sweater over a black top and shiny silver pants, which caught attention in the whirling lights of the club, and later played a role in witnesses claiming to have seen her. According to the friends that Karina had gone with that night, she was seen throughout the club sporadically. The group of friends would often split up as they danced and talked with others, though they would usually gather back together at different points, and especially when the club was getting ready to close. Karina was reported to have been drinking a little more than usual this evening, and each time she bumped into a friend, she was said to have been showing more signs of intoxication. As the evening drove to a close, the last sightings of Karina are a compilation of differing accounts and contradictory information, which will later cause investigators to try and sort through the confusion of taking eyewitness statements from a small group of individuals who were, for the most part, intoxicated and not exactly reliable. Lieutenant Robert O'Toole later said, quote, "We know she was there with friends, and we know she was talking to some men, which is not unusual. She was talking inside, but whether she left with anyone is total conjecture." End quote. Shortly before the club was set to close, at 3 a.m., it's been reported that Karina was found incredibly drunk and either passed out or possibly just very out of it in a bathroom. A bouncer reportedly walked Karina out of the club at this time, and she found herself spat out into an alley outside. When she tried to regain access, she was denied. Here is where statements tend to diverge. For the most part, the friends she had attended the club with reported that they couldn't locate her as the club shut down. They waited around for a period of time, and she never materialized, and so they went their separate ways and headed home, assuming that she had done the same, or had simply gone elsewhere. Others have reported that, prior to closing, Karina had explained that she was planning to attend an after-hours party with some people she had met, though that has never been confirmed either. Still yet, a witness reported seeing Karina speaking with a homeless man outside. The man is said to have sang and danced with Karina in the alley for a few minutes before she wandered off. She was also reported to have engaged in conversation with Herb Witten, a 49-year-old who often drove into the city with his Great Pyrenees, in hopes of using it as a method for meeting women. It's been said that, oftentimes, Witten would put a Superman t-shirt on the dog, and he'd wear a matching one. In yet another account, a man later spoke to police and stated that he was friends with Karina and had seen her getting into a car with a group of men. According to this witness, he spotted Karina entering a gray Mitsubishi. The man alleges that he walked up to the vehicle, leaned into the window and stated, quote, "Let's go, you came here with us," end quote, in an attempt to get her out of the car, but was later confronted by one of the occupants, who supposedly responded, quote, "Get away from the car, you little shit, or I'll crush your fucking head," end quote. The final report places Karina not in a vehicle, but by herself, sometime between 3 and 4 a.m., walking up Tremont Street between Boylston and Park Streets. Wherever Karina was during this time has been highly debated, but one thing which is known for certain is that Karina had vanished sometime before 4 a.m. It's not believed that she ever made it back to the loft that night. There have been reports about surveillance cameras in the area picking up sightings of her as she walked home, but these reports were later refuted. It was 1996, and while surveillance cameras did exist, there were a lot less than there are today, and their video quality was poor at best. For the next 30 hours, Karina was gone. Unfortunately, since she had disappeared on a Friday night, early Saturday morning, she wasn't expected to return to work until Monday, so her host family had no way of knowing that she was missing. No missing persons report was filed, since no one quite knew that Karina hadn't returned home. No one heard from her on Saturday, though whether or not this was normal is unknown. It does seem a little unlikely that, after going out on Friday nights, Karina wouldn't have usually made plans to go out again on Saturday, but it appears that no one thought it was odd for her to be out of contact that day and night. This is a time before the prevalence of cell phones, and so there are no records to check which would likely show at least some texts back and forth if this happened today. In the early morning hours of Sunday, June 23rd, a homeless man was making the rounds, checking trash cans and dumpsters for bottles and cans to turn in for change. The man wandered around the area of Fenway Park, home to the Boston Red Sox, and eventually made his way towards a graffiti-laden open-top dumpster in an alley behind 1901 Boylston Street. He climbed into the dumpster and began digging through the trash, but one item was heavy and hindering his search. He reached out and attempted to move the large black trash bag, but as he touched it, he found its contents felt strange. Whether accidentally or with the purpose of discovering what lay within, the man pulled at the plastic material until the bag ripped open. He immediately withdrew in panic, as inside the bag, he spotted a human arm. Crawling back out of the dumpster, the man went running down the alley calling for help until he found a police officer. Officers swarmed the scene, and after removing the 48-pound trash bag, were shocked. Inside was the nude upper half of a woman's body, sheared in a straight line above the hip. The body appeared to have been washed clean. The makeup was scrubbed off. There was no blood, and the cut had been made precisely, other than what appeared to be a deviation which hit the hip bone. The blonde-haired victim had noticeable strangulation bruising on her neck, and later examination found that the cut had likely been made with a high-powered tool, such as a circular saw. Whoever had made the cut had done so below the ribs and above the hip, making it such that the only bone which needed to be severed was the spine. A later autopsy would find that the cause of death was strangulation, and there had been some blunt force trauma to the neck area. It appeared that the victim had been strangled with a length of rope. Identification of the victim was difficult due to the fact that there was no identification or clothing present, and even if they had found the ID, it would not have provided her real information. Detective Tommy O'Leary was placed in charge of the case and immediately assigned officers to begin canvassing the area, searching for anyone who may have seen the victim or activity near the dumpster in the past few days. The dumpster was located in a busy area, so this was considered a high possibility. The body itself was approximately 2 miles to the west-southwest of Zanzibar, and it's important to note that Karina's loft was located off to the southeast of the club, suggesting that she had either been taken by someone or gone along willingly with her killer, leading her in the opposite direction of her home. Police were baffled by the gruesome scene, trying to determine the reason for bisecting the body. An initial theory suggested the removal of her lower body may have been an attempt to conceal sexual assault and to remove possible forensic evidence. The reason for the vicious act has never been officially discovered, though, and Karina's lower half has never been found. Investigators were hindered from the outset by several factors. First and foremost, Based upon the condition of the scene, the lack of blood, they didn't know the location at which the murder had taken place. Beyond that, they had a victim they couldn't identify and extremely limited forensic evidence. Because her body had been cleaned, there was nothing which crime scene technicians could utilize to point detectives in any direction. The killer had been skilled and efficient, though he or she did make one mistake. When examining the trash bag for evidence, a partial fingerprint was lifted from the inside of the bag. The partial print remains unidentified to this day, and whether or not it belongs to the killer with 100% certainty can't be known. In an attempt to obtain an ID on the victim and hopefully gain tips about what may have occurred, police issued a statement to the press regarding what they had found. It wasn't long after their statement that they received a call from Frank Rapp, who reported that he had been unable to get in touch with his Swedish au pair and knew that she often spent her weekends at the clubs of Boston. After gaining a name and the names of people who may have been with her that night, officers were sent to speak to Frank Rapp, and others reached out to the friends. One woman, another Swedish nanny, spoke to the Boston Globe under an agreement of anonymity, discussing having been with Karina the night she vanished. She claimed that Karina had left the club with an older man, stating that they were, quote, going to an after-hours party. The next time I saw her was to identify her body, end quote. Boston police contacted the FBI and spent 2 days discussing the murder with experts from their behavioral sciences team, hoping to create a profile of the type of person who would commit such a violent and vicious crime. At the time, O'Leary was determined to map out the last 48 hours of Karina's life. He wanted to determine who she had spoken to, where she had been, and who'd been around her. It was his belief that if they could get a clearer picture of her comings and goings that weekend, they might be able to find someone who possessed vital information, even if that person didn't know what they knew was important. Authorities were given the wide array of eyewitness reports discussed previously, with all of them telling a different tale about who Karina may have been with and where she may have been going. The first person that police locked onto for questioning was Herb Witten, the so-called man with the dog. Several witnesses reported seeing Karina speaking with him the night she disappeared, and he was a known fixture outside of clubs and bars on the weekends. His presence that night was confirmed when police were given copies of Zanzibar's security camera footage, which captured him in the area. Authorities located Witten in Andover, approximately 23 miles north of Boston. Witten explained that he often came to Boston late in the evening on Friday and Saturday nights, along with his dog, in an attempt to get attention from women while he walked around the city. The dog was part of his plan, as he found women were more interested in speaking to him if they could be petting the dog at the same time. In terms of Karina, Witten reported that he didn't know what had happened to her, and while his behavior seemed odd and his dog scheme certainly entered the realm of the creepy, he had a fairly tight alibi. Witten had received a speeding ticket on his way home to Andover in the early morning hours, making the timeline tight. Could Witten have been able to murder and dismember Karina in an unknown location and managed to dispose of her body in the dumpster in such a short amount of time? That was difficult to determine, as autopsy results were somewhat inconclusive, suggesting that Karina may have been murdered anywhere between 4 a.m. Saturday and 4 a.m. Sunday, meaning that the young woman may have been alive as long as 24 hours before being dismembered and placed in the dumpster. There was some debate about whether or not Witten could have had Karina in his possession, perhaps in the trunk of his car, at the time of the ticket, and that he later may have returned to the dumpster. Witten was a larger man, described as somewhat burly, and people who knew him reported that he was often building things. Whether or not he had access to electrical saws is unknown, but not impossible. Police did request permission to examine his vehicle, which was granted, but found nothing which indicated that Karina had been inside, nor did they see any evidence of a crime having been committed. Witten was considered, for the most part, an unlikely suspect, though some have reported that he often behaved oddly and may have been suffering from a mental illness. He was said to be moody, the type of person who could be happy-go-lucky one moment and angry over the smallest thing the next. While he could have been the perpetrator, most didn't feel that he possessed the intelligence or foresight to clean the body, nor likely the expertise to make such a clean cut in the bisecting. Unfortunately, any information Witten may have possessed about Karina and her murder would go to the grave with him. Just 5 months after the crime was committed, Andover police were called to the home of Witten's sister. He was found deceased in the bathroom, apparently due to suicide. Police reported that Witten had slit his own throat, and there was some debate at the time about whether or not this could have been a murder. A legal representative for Witten later spoke to police and suggested that public exposure and paranoia may have led to his client taking his own life. This event, coupled with reports of his mental instability and knowledge that he had been in the same area as Karina that night, have led many to believe that his suicide was based around fear that he would eventually be discovered to have committed this crime, though no evidence has ever been found to prove this, and it remains speculative. The next target of police scrutiny was Karina's host family, Frank Rapp and Susan Nichter. After speaking with other au pairs and nannies, they were told disturbing stories about Frank himself. Many of the women described him as a creep, saying that his behavior could be sleazy, and that he was known to, at some times, be flirtatious, and at others, to cross the line and be more directly suggestive. There was a rumor at the time that Karina may have been pregnant, and some believe Rat may have been the father. This led to a belief that her body had been cut to conceal a pregnancy, and perhaps that this was the terrible thing that had happened that she had written home about. None of this has ever been founded in fact, though. Whether or not Karina may have been pregnant is unknown, as the details of the autopsy have never been fully revealed, and it should be pointed out that, if she was, it was unlikely she would have known, since she spent her last night drinking more than usual. The possibility of a sexual assault, though, remained. Many believe that her fear of being deported may have resulted in her not going to authorities, but it's important to note all of this is merely rumor and speculation. When investigators spoke to the family, they found them difficult, even hostile, and very uncooperative. Neither possessed an alibi for their whereabouts during the time of the crime, and rather quickly into the investigation, they required all police inquiry to be directed through their lawyer. It's been suggested that their use of a lawyer implies some kind of guilt, but most lawyers would advise clients to never speak to police without them present as a matter of precaution. In a rare comment to the press, Frank Rapp stated, quote, "I am definitely not a suspect. My family is completely devastated," end quote. One curious detail, though, would make the Boston police more suspicious of the family. When they went up to Dover to speak with Rapp and Nichter, they were accompanied by members of the Dover Police Department, as is protocol when conducting an investigation inside of a different jurisdiction. At the time, they were informed of a bizarre event which had taken place on the Monday following the discovery of Karina's remains. Dover police had been dispatched to a dumpster located on property shared by the family and neighbors at approximately 9:20 p.m. Someone had set a fire inside of the dumpster, and Dover police had recovered the charred remains of clothing and various pieces of trash. The dumpster itself had been extensively damaged in the fire. The items were later turned over to the Boston police for examination, as it was considered possible that if the couple were involved, they may have been attempting to destroy evidence. Unfortunately, after processing the items, none tested positive for blood, and no traces of human remains were discovered. The individual who set the blaze was never identified, though Carmen Fields, a spokeswoman for the Suffolk County District Attorney, later expressed to the media that it had been determined that the items in the dumpster did not likely belong to Karina Homer. In response to the dumpster fire and the fact that Karina's remains had been discovered in a dumpster also, police sent cadaver dogs to a trash transfer station located in Dover though nothing was ever publicly reported about anything being found. In a follow-up regarding Rapp, investigators searched the loft where Karina stayed on the weekends and pulled the telephone records. Despite an exhaustive search, nothing was found which would indicate that a crime had taken place there, and it appeared as though Karina hadn't returned to the loft after her night out. While tensions remained high between authorities and the family, there was no evidence to suggest that they had been involved, at least no solid evidence. Suspicions abound, but no links could be made. There was a debate about whether or not the family had lawyered up due to potential involvement, or to protect their interests since they had illegally hired and housed an au pair who hadn't gone through the proper immigration and visa requirements. Either way, police had no choice but to move forward and seek answers elsewhere. The report about Karina getting into a vehicle with a group of men was followed up on, though the details were scarce, and without further information there was little investigators could do. They didn't have names, and outside of a vague description of the vehicle, there was almost nothing which could be done. The vehicle was mentioned in some discussions with the press, and police expressed their interest in speaking to any individuals who may have been in a car with Karina that night, though none ever came forward. For the most part, police ultimately believed it was unlikely that Karina had been inside a car outside of the club, and that the account of her being seen walking up Tremont Street alone is believed to be the last confirmed sighting of the young woman before her murder. Another name which came up during the investigation was John Zweiss. Zweiss, real name John McSweeney, is a musician who lived in the area where Karina's remains were discovered. What led authorities to him has never been clarified, though it appears that Zweiss was known as an odd character who had strange predilections. There were rumors of him operating in so-called black magic, and that he may have been involved in devil worship. One potential reason for Zweiss's alleged connection may have been an interview he took part in with the Boston Phoenix, in which he made the following statement, quote, "I have human thigh bones that we use in a magical ritual," end quote. Police did speak with Zweiss on at least one occasion, though nothing came out of the conversation. He was considered a person of interest for a period of time, though it appeared that authorities moved on from considering him and accounted for most of his behavior and statements to have been connected to his image, more so than actual activities that he took part in or believed in. Further investigation into Karina's personal life had found two pieces of information which were considered curious. Firstly, Karina had been involved in a relationship with a man from South Boston in the months before her murder. Authorities did manage to track down this man and speak with him, though they felt that he was unlikely to be involved and did have an alibi for the night of Karina's death. Another boyfriend was found, and in a strange connection, he was actually a member of the Boston Police Department. Not a great deal of information is available about this particular man. Even his name has never been publicly revealed. Boston police did, however, express that the officer was thoroughly questioned and investigated, and they did not believe he was connected to the crime either. This statement raised some eyebrows, as some felt that the Boston police may have been involved in a cover-up, and that department was certainly experiencing its fair share of scandals in the 90s, though it has been suggested that this crime would likely have been far too mainstream at the time to successfully cover up. Unfortunately, the details surrounding this aspect of Karina's life may never be fully known. Despite their efforts, investigators were simply hitting dead ends everywhere they turned. In total, they questioned more than 300 potential witnesses or persons of interest, but found nothing which could make a concrete connection. Thousands of tips poured in from Boston and around the country, alleged sightings, and reports of disturbing individuals who may have been responsible. But again, when the leads were tracked down, they went nowhere. Eugene McCullum, a confessed murderer who had decapitated his victims in Massachusetts, was questioned in connection to Karina's death, though again, no link could be made. He was later convicted on other charges, and police stated that they did not believe he was involved in Karina's murder. It seemed that no matter what police did, who they spoke to, and where they looked, They simply couldn't find the person responsible for this startlingly disturbing crime. American media spoke with Karina's sister Johanna, who was solemn and devastated by the loss. She stated, quote, "Of course we know such things can happen over there, but it's nothing you expect," end quote. In a heartbreaking phone call, Detective Tommy O'Leary spoke with Karina's father. The discussion about the crime, a potential perpetrator, and any evidence discovered was short. The police simply had little to go on, but the call took a turn when Ola Holmer discussed the return of his daughter. Detective O'Leary later stated, quote, "When I finally talked to Karina's father, one of the first things he said to me was, 'What am I getting back?' I was floored. I explained, 'You're getting her upper torso. You're getting her beautiful face.'" End quote. Karina's remains were sent back to Sweden, and a funeral service was held. Friends and family attended wearing bright colors to celebrate her life, and Karina was laid to rest in a white casket draped with flowers. In May of 1999, an employee at a pet supermarket in Florida made the horrifying discovery of a woman's body, severed in two, in a dumpster behind the store. The woman was later identified as Delia Lorna Mendez. She was 32 and known to police as a local sex worker. Both parts of her body were found, the lower half being unclothed. Boston police reached out when they discovered the similarities. Hollywood, Florida Police Lieutenant Chad Wagner initially stated, quote, "Right now, however, there are as many dissimilarities as similarities. It's still a possibility, and we will know more when the medical examiner's report comes back," end quote. Boston Homicide Lieutenant Paul Farahar explained, quote, "As information develops, we will take the appropriate action. It has piqued our interest enough to be in contact with their police department," end quote. Ultimately, experts felt there was unlikely a connection between the two. The condition of Mendez's body suggested a quick, frenzied attack and bisection. The bloody dumpster seemed to indicate a disorganized attacker, while Karina's murderer appeared methodical and had planned it out. Several murders have taken place since Karina's, which have caused authorities to take a look and see if there's a connection, though none has ever been found. One of the more recent ones took place in April of 2016. Carlos Colina Jr. of Cambridge, Massachusetts, was charged with the murder of his friend, Jonathan Chameleon. Police had found a duffel bag which contained Chameleon's torso and some of his limbs, and witnesses had reported seeing Colina in the area with the duffel bag. Colina was a diagnosed schizophrenic and reported hearing the devil speaking to him when he failed to take his medication. While Colina would have been 13 at the time of Karina's murder, the case did momentarily bring her story back into the headlines. Susan Nichter, the wife of Frank Rapp, later drew negative attention based around her artwork. The former host family for Karina had drawn suspicion early on, but as years passed, individuals examining Susan's gallery were disturbed by what they saw. Several of Nichter's images displayed haunting depictions of violent scenes, and a woman who some felt resembled Karina. While this is hardly evidence of any true merit, and the interpretation of artwork is a complex art in and of itself, there are some who believe that there may be some truth involved in these scenes. Others, however, have argued that perhaps it was the shock of the murder itself which inspired the pieces, and not the act of having been involved in it directly. It's been 22 years since Karina Holmer's life was taken in a brutal and grisly fashion. The person responsible has never been brought to justice, and the partial print recovered at the scene has never been matched. The rest of Karina's body hasn't been located, and it seems unlikely at this time that it ever will be. Boston police continue to work the case today and list it as active, but there is little, if any, movement. Over the years, they have traveled across the country to study and examine crimes of a similarly haunting nature, to seek out connections, to hope for answers, but have never succeeded in finding the truth. David Mayer, a former prosecutor for the Suffolk County District Attorney, thinks of Karina's case as the one which he will never forget. In an interview, he stated, quote, "It's as haunting today as it was 20 years ago, if not more so, because no one has come forward. Because whoever is responsible for this, whether it's one person or more than one person, has apparently not slipped up and said anything to anyone who would have an interest in saying anything. And there's no crime scene. There's no ability to determine with any definite basis how she was killed, why she was killed, where she was killed, never mind who killed her." End quote. Tommy O'Leary moved on from his detective position, becoming a commander in District B2, but he still remembers the case and will never stop wondering what happened. In an interview in 2016, O'Leary stated, quote, "I can't drive through the Fenway section of Boston without thinking about her, and that's pretty much every day of my life. I've spent a lot of time at the dumpster site and at the Catholic church on the corner. I don't think about it every day anymore, but I think about her almost every day." End quote. In a case such as this, there are far more theories than there is information or evidence. A case this brutal, this tragic, and this sadistic, one would expect to garner a wider range of attention. And yet, following the year it happened, little if anything has been said. Among the theories which stand out for those who have examined the case, there are three which are slated to be amongst the most likely. The first theory suggests that Karina's murder came as the result of her interactions with Herb Witten, the man with the dog who later committed suicide in the bathroom of his sister's home. Supporters of this theory believe that Witten may have abducted Karina that night and, in an attempt to sexually assault her, may have killed her and then made the choice to cut her body in hopes of disposing of it more easily. The second theory follows the possibility that Karina's murder may be connected to a yet unknown suspect. It is known that she was highly intoxicated outside of the club that night, and many believe the friendly young woman may have met someone who offered to give her a ride to another party, or perhaps home, at which point she was abducted and murdered. The crime itself seems to have called for planning, a location, and the tools with which to commit this heinous act, but for many, that doesn't necessarily imply that the victim had to be a specific person. Also in line with the unknown suspect theory is one of the unnamed suspects in the case, the Boston police officer who dated her. Could this all truly be part of a cover-up? The third and final theory is that Karina's death had something to do with her host family. Many believe that, at a minimum, Frank Rapp and Susan Nichter may be in possession of more information than they have shared, and rumors have circulated around the family for the past 20 years. Some believe that Karina may have either been engaged in a relationship with Rapp or may have been the victim of sexual assault from him. While all of that remains speculative, for many, it's difficult to dismiss the family's response to the crime and the speed with which they withdrew from discussing it. And then, of course, there's the dumpster fire and the artwork. The murder of Karina Homer is incredibly difficult to examine. A smart, kind, beautiful young woman dreamed of seeing the world. She came to America in hopes of exploring, meeting others, and having adventures. And sadly, only part of her ever returned home. Her family has never been given the answers they seek, and in this rapidly turning world of media and shocking stories, her name has, in many ways, been brushed aside in favor of whatever new horror may come along. But for those who knew her, those who loved her, and those who dedicated themselves to finding the truth, things will never be silenced until justice is done. David Mayer explained, quote, "For the family of Karina Homer, nothing would be more satisfying than bringing them some sense of justice, some resolution. I don't want to say it would take a miracle, but it would take an extraordinary piece of evidence to charge someone, let alone prove it beyond a reasonable doubt. There is nothing about this case which is ordinary, and there's everything about this case that is extraordinary." The murder of Corina Homer is an incredibly disturbing and haunting story. A young woman from a small village in Sweden ends up in a large American city and never makes it home. Her family is left wondering who could have done this, and unfortunately, being located so far away, they don't possess the ability to press for information or to keep the story alive in the media. As the years have gone by, this story has slowly fallen by the wayside for reasons I can't begin to comprehend. If you're like me, then this case echoes shades of the infamous Black Dahlia case, which 70 years later continues to maintain its prominence, and yet Corina's story is barely known. Both are horrifying. Both involve the murder and bisection of a young woman. What makes one stand out more than the other? Corina's case is filled with dead ends and contradictions. From the moment she vanished to the time her remains were found, there are various stories and rumors circulating around the case. From rumors about her former employer, debates about boyfriends, and the confusion surrounding her letters home, there's so little evidence available that, for the most part, investigators consider it highly unlikely they'll ever catch her killer. Everything about this case has been debated extensively, even the reasoning behind why Corina's body was dismembered. A common belief is that she may have been pregnant or sexually assaulted, and the cut was made to conceal that fact. Others believe that this may have simply been a matter of making disposal easier for the killer, and that the severing of her body into two pieces made it easier to carry and place them in the dumpster. Some believe that the killer may have kept Corina's legs or disposed of them elsewhere, while yet others argue there's a chance they were simply placed in a different dumpster. Some who have examined this story believe the bisecting was done purposefully, to shock and to be a calling card, but that seems unlikely considering Corina's remains were concealed in a trash bag in a dumpster, not left somewhere they were likely to be found. When you think about it logically, it was purely a matter of happenstance that a homeless man happened to enter that dumpster that day. Is it possible that Corina's other half may have simply been missed in a different dumpster? Absolutely. Regardless of what you may believe about this story, and I highly encourage you to look into it yourself, for most people, the possible suspects and theories about what may have happened can be boiled down to three distinct options. The first of these options focuses in on Herb Witten, the man with the dog who was known for a fact to have been in the area that night, and who several witnesses reported seeing speaking to Corina. There's a lot of stories circulating about Herb Witten, some substantiated and others chalked up completely to rumor. What we know for certain is that Witten frequently traveled into Boston looking to meet women and would bring his dog along with him. Witten appears to have been known to the locals, or at least there were stories about him. No one had any accounts of him being violent or threatening, though I have read some reports where he was described as the type of person who could get angry fairly easily. There's debate amongst people about whether or not Witten had some sort of mental illness, with a few people stating that they thought he had bipolar tendencies, considering the speed with which he was known to change his moods. That's all speculative and hard to go on, but based around the fact that Witten would later commit suicide, this seems to indicate that he was troubled in one way or another. Witten was seen with Corina the night she vanished, and we know he owned a car. Many believe it's possible he may have offered to give her a ride, noting that she was intoxicated. This is certainly a possibility, though would Witten have then murdered her? It's difficult to say for certain, but again, this can't be ruled out. Most of what appeared to clear Witten was the fact that he was ticketed for speeding on the night Corina disappeared, and investigators felt it was unlikely he could have taken her somewhere, committed the murder, conducted the dismemberment, and then gotten her into the dumpster on that tight of a timeline. But this is all assuming that this took place on the same night. Even the medical examiner has said it's possible that Corina was alive as long as 24 hours after she disappeared. If this is the case, then there's nothing which says that Witten couldn't have been in possession of Corina, or perhaps had her concealed at a location, before or during the time that he received the ticket. If nothing else, getting a speeding ticket away from the city at the time would actually be a fairly intelligent method by which to give yourself an alibi. It's hard to judge Witten's intelligence, there isn't a lot of information available about specifics such as that, But it's not impossible he could have done this. We know that whoever committed this crime had a location and the tools available to commit this terrible act. It was clearly planned out. Who's to say that the speeding ticket wasn't all part of this elaborate plan? As far as we know, Witten met Karina for the first time that night. Of course, there is the possibility that they had talked before since he frequently came downtown to try and meet women. The 49-year-old may have found himself enamored by the 20-year-old Swedish nanny, and once that began, it's simply impossible for us to know if he would have become obsessed to the point of lashing out violently or making aggressive advances on her. A young woman, stumbling outside of a club at 3 a.m., clearly intoxicated, can certainly become an easy target for the wrong person. We may never know where the crime took place or why it happened, but I wouldn't be so quick to have written Witten off. There may have been evidence in the possession of investigators beyond the speeding ticket, which gave them a reason to dismiss him as a potential suspect. We know that they were able to examine his car, but it seemed that this was a matter of officers taking a look inside and into the trunk. It doesn't appear that the crime scene technicians were able to conduct extensive examinations, sweeping for hair and fibers, for instance. So it's entirely possible that a cursory look at the vehicle may not have revealed all there was to have been found. For many, it is less Witten's strange behavior around the time of Karina's death that makes him suspicious, but specifically his suicide 5 months later. Witten was found in the bathtub with his throat cut. This is a rare maneuver in terms of suicide, as most people would slice their wrists or even the arteries in their thighs. You don't often see a suicide by cutting of the throat, and the sheer act of doing so must have been difficult to accomplish. This led many to believe that Witten himself may have been murdered, and I've read accounts that police initially considered the possibility. The question would become, why would someone murder him? Nothing was ever found to answer that question, though some have speculated that Witten may have either known the person responsible for Karina's death, or possibly had been involved as an accomplice. All of that is interesting enough, but speculative at best. It's definitely suspicious that Witten chose to end his life so quickly after the murder. His lawyer said it was due to exposure and paranoia, but it's difficult to know if that was tied to the murder or his own possible mental illness. Suffice it to say, the death of Witten is a major roadblock in the case, and if he was responsible, we may never know that answer. It all comes down to the way you view Witten, either as the slightly strange older man who wandered Boston with a dog, looking to harmlessly pick up women, or as a potential predator with a propensity for mood swings who could have violently struck out against a woman who rejected him. The two major issues with Witten, for me at least, are the fact that authorities had a partial print, and if Witten was looked into, it's hard to imagine there wasn't a comparison made. The second is that this crime was planned out. It was organized. It was done efficiently. It seems highly unlikely that someone who would go through this much trouble wouldn't have, at some point, been involved in another crime. Perhaps he was, but again, these answers have never been located. Witten certainly remains a possibility, but unfortunately, is also a dead end himself. The second theory brings us down the long and winding road of potentially unknown or unnamed suspects. In here, we have a handful. The man in the gray Mitsubishi, the Boston police officer who had a relationship with Karina, musician John Zweiss, and a yet unknown individual who may have slipped by investigators' radar. Starting from the top, with the men in the car, there seems to be little to substantiate this claim. All of this spins out of a story a man told authorities early on in the investigation. His story has never been supported by anyone else, and none of Karina's friends have publicly acknowledged the situation. If indeed he had confronted a group of men in a car, into which Karina is said to have gone, how did no one else see this altercation? Surveillance cameras didn't pick up the car he described, no corroborating witnesses exist to support his claims, and the men themselves were never located. This doesn't mean they didn't exist, but it certainly makes it difficult to know if you're being told the truth here. This was a methodical crime, executed with organization and precision, which doesn't seem to fit the mold of a group of angry guys in a car who are willing to argue with someone outside of a club. Possible, but there's just not enough information here to go on. Moving on to the Boston police officer, this is certainly an aspect which has drawn a lot of attention. Unfortunately, much like the men in the car, there's little to go on. Obviously, investigators learned of this man, though I am super curious to know if he came forward or if they found out later. One would depict a man who was open and honest, the other would show someone who was trying to hide something. We know very little about this man, outside of the fact that the Boston police explained they had spoken with him, questioned him, and cleared him. I know that the Boston Police Department of the mid-1990s was a corrupt institution, and there were a lot of issues there, but this seems a rather large crime to cover up. While there should never be any cover-ups when it comes to police actions, this is a bit beyond lying to protect a cop who displayed excessive force or shot a witness in a bad situation. This is a man who would have strangled a 20-year-old woman to death, cut her in half, and then left part of her in a dumpster. The national media attention on this case at the time alone would have been enough to add a dramatic amount of pressure to the department. How many officers would be willing to go out of their way to protect the kind of sick and twisted person who would commit a crime like this? Police corruption certainly exists, and we get new examples of it constantly, but this would seem to go far beyond the bounds of a normal cover-up, if such a thing exists. I also find it difficult to believe that, after all this time, no one would have leaked information about it from within the department. Unfortunately, again, we simply don't know. We don't know the nature of the relationship. We don't know how it went or whether it was ongoing at the time. It seems more likely, were an officer involved in this, it wouldn't have been done in this way. Likely a shooting and disposal of the body elsewhere. A Boston cop would know where to put a body if he didn't want it to be found. The police officer angle is certainly intriguing, but there's simply not enough evidence to support it at this time. John Zweis is an interesting character to examine, but there appears to be almost nothing here to connect him to the crime. He was allegedly brought up as a potential suspect because of some bizarre statements he made and the fact that he lived a couple of blocks away from the dumpster where Karina's body was found. That's not much to go on, and for the most part, it seems that Zweis's statements were little more than a musician trying to display some edge and stand out. This was the mid-90s, the heyday of artists like Marilyn Manson who were completely based in that shock jock mentality. There's never been anything presented to connect Zweis to the crime, and authorities were fairly quick to move off of him in regard to his possible involvement. A weird guy who was out to make a name for himself in the music world? Certainly. But a violent psychopath who's going to abduct, murder, and dismember a random woman from a club? Well, that seems a bit unlikely. Then there is the ever-present possibility of a completely unknown suspect who could commit this terrible crime and never even get considered as a person of interest, nor even spoken to by authorities. The idea of this being a random incident has been dismissed by some because the nature of the crime suggested planning. But some have argued that just because the act itself was planned doesn't mean the victim needed to be anyone in particular. A drunken woman who was struggling to get around outside of a club would certainly lend herself to being victimized by this type of sadistic predator. The possibility of an unknown suspect is fairly limitless in terms of what could have happened. Someone meeting her outside of the club, someone coming upon her while she's walking, or even someone who met her in the club and then ran into her later. We do know that some friends reported that Karina had told them she was going to an after-hours party with someone, or a group of people, whom she had met at the club. Of course, the fact that she was later seen outside by herself calls this into question. If this did happen, who knows where this person or persons could have taken her, or what intentions they may have had in mind. The sad fact of the matter is that, in a state like she was in at the time, she was not really in a position to fight against someone who had bad intentions, and it may have been easy for someone to convince her to go along. While, yes, she was in Boston, we do have to remember that she was from a small Swedish village. Perhaps this left her more open to be manipulated by a calm and cool psychopath, the likes of which she'd never met before. The possibility of a completely unknown suspect has to be considered. One detail which always felt like it implicated someone unfamiliar with the area was the location in which her body was found. This person didn't drive Karina out to a desolate area, or take her somewhere where people were unlikely to see disposal of her remains. She was left in a dumpster, in a busy area where, even late at night and early in the morning, there was still the possibility of someone walking by. Some have suggested that the killer may have in fact simply selected that dumpster because it was the first one seen while driving by. The dumpster is clearly visible from a busy turnpike. If indeed this was a stranger murder and random attack, whoever committed the crime has either managed to stay out of trouble since then, died, or has become more efficient in his work. Karina was found by chance. There's an endless number of missing persons who may have fallen victim to the same suspect, who were never found. Some believe that the crime seems impersonal. The cleaning, the cutting, the disposal. They believe it suggests someone who did not view Karina as a person, but as an object. For others, though, the brutality which was displayed has to be connected to someone who had a personal vendetta against her, and that leads us to the final theory, that Karina's host family may have been involved. When it comes to Frank Rapp and Susan Nichter, there isn't much to say. From moment one, they didn't speak to the press. They were confrontational with authorities, and they shielded themselves behind a lawyer. I don't believe that having a lawyer handle the process is necessarily a sign of guilt, and in most circumstances, if you can have a lawyer talking for you, you're better off. The fact that they were described as hostile, though, is interesting. Why would this family, who claimed to have been devastated by the loss, have been so unwilling to cooperate with authorities in giving over information that could have helped solve the crime? It's difficult to tell the truth from the rumors here. We know that some of Karina's friends referred to Rapp as a creep and suggested that he may have been trying to take liberties with young women. Out of this, spawned a flood of rumors that Rapp may have either been involved in a relationship with Karina or perhaps was assaulting her. Unfortunately, that isn't exactly uncommon amongst au pairs. There are many accounts of women coming from other countries and being physically, mentally, or sexually assaulted by someone in their host family. In Karina's case, this would have been even easier to do, since she was here illegally, and someone could have used that information to threaten her. Unfortunately, we simply don't know what was going on, and Karina's cryptic letters home don't aid in that process. We will forever wonder what the terrible thing that happened was, and we will likely never know for sure. Outside of their lack of cooperation, the dumpster fire certainly drew attention onto the family, but again, there's not much to go on here. The property was shared, the dumpster was public. Anyone could have set the fire, and who knows why exactly they'd have done so. If you wanted to dispose of evidence, there are ways to do it that aren't going to draw attention like a dumpster fire will. Authorities later determined that nothing in the dumpster was connected to Karina, so this almost seems like a red herring. I'm not a huge believer in coincidence, but it's entirely possible that the two events were unrelated, though I admit it does seem highly suspicious. Another angle which came up in later years was the imagery depicted in Nichter's paintings. I admit, having seen them, that you can easily be disturbed by what you see, but that doesn't necessarily connect to the crime. The idea that this woman either has knowledge of or was involved in this murder, and then later went on not only to paint it, but to publicly display that work, seems a little too much like the plot of a Murder, She Wrote episode to me. This is not to say that it's impossible, but it's somewhat unlikely. As I stated previously, artwork is highly subject to interpretation, and while I totally understand seeing these images and making that connection, I can just as easily see Karina's murder having had a traumatic impact on Nichter, who then worked her into her art, either consciously or unconsciously. When you cut through everything which can't be based in fact and can designate it only as rumor, you have very little to work with here. What we know for certain is that they were her host family, and at some point in time, Karina decided she didn't want to do it anymore. They claim they didn't know she was unhappy, and that she never expressed this to them. It's difficult to argue against that. Whether there was an inappropriate relationship going on, we may never know. Some people believe it was consensual, others believe it wasn't. Some have argued that Nichter may have found out and struck out against Karina, others that Nichter may have actually been involved in the relationship. The one factor of it which has always seemed strange is that, if indeed a member of this family wanted to eliminate Karina, why would they wait until a night where she was going to be in downtown Boston? They had access to her all week. They certainly could have done something to her on a Monday, and either chosen not to report her missing, since she was here illegally and not on any records, or to have reported her missing weeks later and claimed that she had been there recently. Most people find it difficult to believe that this well-to-do family, if indeed they wanted to eliminate their au pair, for one reason or another, would have needed to go to these lengths to do so, and would ultimately have disposed of her in a dumpster downtown. It simply doesn't make sense, and while Rapp and Nichter have displayed some behavior that is worthy of suspicion, they certainly haven't done anything else to warrant that attention. It's difficult to imagine that they would have committed such a heinous and violent crime, and then, over the next 22 years, never have been involved in anything else. Remember, police do possess a partial print, and it's difficult to imagine they wouldn't have wanted to compare it to one or both of them. Whether or not they were legally able to do so, though, remains uncertain. While this is definitely an area of the case which needs further exploration, and I wish very much that the family would cooperate and speak publicly, like almost every other theory in this case, we have almost nothing to go on. This case is mostly a matter of speculation and rumor. A bright, beautiful, kind, and caring 20-year-old left home to see the world and didn't make it back alive. A family was forever broken, and the sick individual responsible has never had to face justice for this hideous crime. The murder of Karina Homer is gruesome, disturbing, heartbreaking, and haunting. 22 years after this terrible crime was committed, longer than Karina herself was alive, and we are nowhere closer to learning the truth. Unfortunately, after all of this time, even those who have worked to solve this case find it difficult to imagine that the answers are ever going to be found. It appears to be one of those cases that may remain unsolved, but there's always hope that something will break. Perhaps someday that partial print will match. Maybe somebody will finally come forward with further information, or new investigative techniques and technologies will open the door to possibilities. Until then, the murder of Karina Homer remains open, unsolved, and extremely cold. If you're looking for more information about the murder of Karina Homer, there are some articles and discussion available, though they are fairly limited. If you have any information about the murder of Karina Homer, please contact the Boston Police Department or the FBI. What do you believe happened? Tweet me at TraceEvPod, message me on Instagram at TraceEvidencePod, email me at TraceEvidencePod@gmail.com, or comment in the Facebook group. I wanted to give a very special thank you to Isabel Eriksson, a longtime listener and friend who helped me with my Swedish pronunciation. I know I didn't do that great, but I would have done a lot worse without your help, so very much thank you, Isabel. I want to give a special shout out to Patreon producers Krista Colvin, Diane Dyson, Kate Alexander, Lucy LaRue, Lynn Merschel, and Sarah Burrow. Make sure you check your emails, as I'm awaiting responses from several of you regarding your trace evidence gear. Your support makes this show possible. If you're interested in supporting Trace Evidence, visit patreon.com/traceevidence. If you've enjoyed this episode, please rate and review the show on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast app you're using. The more ratings and reviews the show gets, the more people are able to hear these unsolved cases. For more information about other cases, transcripts, media, and more, please visit the website at trace-evidence.com. I'm going to leave you with a promo for another podcast, which takes a different look at true crime and sometimes can lift the mood after such a heavy case. I want to thank all of you for listening, and I hope you'll join me next week for another unsolved case on the next episode of Trace Evidence.
What podcast brings you true stories of exceptionally smart and insanely dumb crimes every week?
Dumb and Busted, obviously.
But Hannah, where is your one-stop shop if you want to hear about a killer nurse, a pervy arsonist, or a group of hella old dudes breaking into a vault?
Dumb and Busted. Allison, come on, seriously? We host the show together.
Okay, last question. Where can I go if I need to hear the number one song of 1999, I Want It That Way?
What? The Backstreet Boys album Millennium? How did we even get on this tangent?
Oh, okay. Sorry for being the only one who's ever fallen victim to their tight harmonies and timeless songs. Anyway, please listen and subscribe to Dumb and Busted on iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, Google Play, or anywhere you get your podcasts. Crime you later!